Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Speaking with Jamay Caskio, he's the founder of World Changing Blog and has a very interesting and colorful career before that, which we're going to start with. Jamay, you recently interviewed me, so this is the obligatory quid pro quo. I do audio for you. You do text for me. If those are interested in our previous interview on text, you can go to worldchanging.org and read it there. But we didn't talk about you. So I want to hear how you got involved with transhuman space and what transhuman space is all about.
Well, transhuman space is a classic role-playing game. For those of you who are getting on in years, you may remember Dungeons and Dragons. Games like that don't involve a computer at all. There's still a steady, if somewhat somewhat underground market for these kinds of non-digital, multi-person games, and they cover a wide variety of genres. Just about 4 years ago, Steve Jackson Games, which is a company that's been around for a while, they became most notorious for being involved in an early Secret Service crackdown on hackers, which netted them unintentionally, and they managed to win the lawsuit against the Secret Service.
They had a game that involved hackers.
Had a game that involved hackers, and that triggered the interest of the Secret Service, who didn't understand what's going on.
Confiscated all their computers and all their company records and everything.
Exactly. So more recently, they've been doing other genres of games, and they started a game series called Transhuman Space. The person who wrote the initial book, the game developer by the name of David Pulver, who has done quite a few different science fiction and high-tech oriented role-playing games for different companies. I've known Steve Jackson for, probably close to 8 years now. He and I met when I spoke at South by Southwest back in the mid to late 90s on issues of technology and politics. And we've remained in touch. I've been involved in role-playing games now for a while. And when I heard about Transhuman Space in progress, and he saw the work that I've been doing in different formats, he asked if I'd be interested in submitting a proposal. So I wrote a proposal for what ended up being the first of two books that I did for the series. There are now 11 books in the series. First one was called Broken Dreams, which was a look at what the future would hold for the developing world and intellectual property. Transhuman Space, to sort of give you an idea of the setting, is set in the year 2100. It is as hard science you can make a setting for a game. So there's no faster-than-light travel. There's no telepathy, no humanoid aliens. It's not science fiction. It's not your grandfather's science fiction. This is... it's filled with nanotechnology and bioengineering and artificial intelligence and multiplicity of human-derived species and so forth. There's some colonization of the solar system, but most of your people are on Earth.
I have to say, I haven't read your works yet in this genre, but I read Pulver's Transhuman Space volume. Mm-hmm. And it's for someone who's been immersed in these issues on my side to read and also reads a lot of science fiction, it is a fascinating, it's like an encyclopedic approach to all the different permutations of cybernetic and nanotechnological and genetic and ideological ramifications that these things might have over the course of the next 100-150 years.
And that's an important point. This is not set up as a future where everyone believes the same thing. And so to again extend the contrast with Star Trek, this is a world where that's filled with factions and movements and politics and not just conflict in the violent sense, but a lot of intellectual ferment. This is a world on the cusp of change. Now, people who have been following transhuman issues for a while now will, you know, might read this and think, you know, this is what's happening in 100 years. No way, it's going to be a lot, you know, the change will be a lot bigger than this. And, you know, Pulver acknowledges that he slowed down the pace of change for a couple of reasons. One is that making it 100 years out is a nice round number. It lets you do some other things, such as building out in the solar system, gives you enough time to do that. But also, as much as difficult as it would be for all of us to think about what the other side of a singularity would be like, it's really hard to set up a playable game that's in a setting on the other side of the singularity.
You're a blob. You're in the middle of a bunch of other blobs. And...
Exactly. Exactly. What do you want to do? Well, you've done it.
Right.
So this is, and you're describing it as being somewhat encyclopedic, that's also a good way of thinking about the way these game books present themselves for people who aren't familiar with that kind of material, is that these are not science fiction stories. They don't present you with a plot. What they present you with is the setting for you to develop your own plots. So I think one way of describing these is sort of the bizarre love child of National Geographic, The Economist, and the Let's Go Guide for the Future.
So Broken Dreams is one of these. It's like Pulver's book?
Yes.
Okay.
It's in the same world, so I had to maintain consistency with his books. My focus, however, was on the developing world and the conflict over intellectual property in a world where everyone is tied into the network and... you can have individual, the developed version of RFID tags on everything, and what happens when you have intellectual property haves and have-nots. So that was the first book, and it was actually a fairly dense book. It's not of the two that I did. It's not my favorite. One because it's kind of depressing. I've described it elsewhere as being my vision of what happens if we lose. The second book I did, though, was called Toxic Memes, and it's basically a compendium of political movements and cults and conspiracy theories and pop culture artifacts and all kinds of social and cultural artifacts of what, so that you have a better sense of what it's like to live in this world. And that was a lot of fun to write.
That sounds right up my alley, that's for sure. Both of them actually sound fascinating. You also had a column there for a while with the Johannesburg Globe and Mail?
Yes, indeed.
How did that come about?
Well, in a kind of meandering way. I've had what I've described as a Brownian motion career over the past decade and a half, the sort of going wherever the forces at work on me take me. I was working for a company called Global Business Network, which does scenario planning and strategy, mostly for corporations, but occasionally for governments and nonprofits.
That's a Stuart Brand outfit.
Stuart Brand was one of the five founders of the company, yes, along with Peter Schwartz.
It's a kind of new age business consulting.
Yeah, new age probably has more implications than I would think are accurate. It's more of a, it was an attempt to adopt some academic tools to the world of business planning, because the scenario planning technique came originally out of Rand and was heavily developed by Herman Kahn before Shell took it up, and then Peter Schwartz was one of the people who used it extensively at Shell, spun out his own company to do Global Business Network to do it for other clients. I worked there for a while. Among the people that I got to know while working there was a television producer. Who was one of the executive producers behind Gene Roddenberry's Earth Final Conflict. He wanted to start a new TV show set on Mars, and he and I got to know each other. He asked if I'd want to come down and be a writer and futurist consultant for the show. Now, when Hollywood beckons, it's very hard to say no.
So, I'll take your word for it.
Well, it's a very strange feeling to have people... fly you down and walk you through a set. And I actually wrote a small piece for the pilot that they were shooting, just a scene, and I happened to be there on the day they were shooting my scene.
Cool.
And it was just so incredible to see actors, recognizable actors, speaking the words that I'd written, and having the crew create in three dimensions, in physical space, a bit of the world that I had imagined.
I'm speaking with Jemay Caskio, by the way. Jemay is the co-founder of the World Changing blog at worldchanging.org, and we're talking about his circuitous route to this particular instantiation. So, okay, so you're in Hollywood and you're writing for science fiction.
I get down to Hollywood and the show is canceled before it's even shown, before my boxes are unpacked, and so I'm sort of flailing around for a few months down there trying to figure out, do I want to pursue the television work? Do I want to do something else? And a friend of mine who was in South Africa at the time had been working for a newspaper, and they wanted a new technology writer, and he got me in touch with the editor, and they offered me a position of doing a weekly column for them. And so that pushed me off into a different phase of my career of doing journalism, largely focused around technology.
And you've written for Salon and NPR and lots of
Salon. I've had a piece in Time Magazine, New York Times. I'm sorry, Washington Post rather. A number of different more business technology related journals, and it was a lot of fun. Doing this column, I called it New World, and it was really a look at what kinds of interesting emerging technologies and ideas there were out there.
Okay, talking about the fun part of your career, maybe this will be our last digression before we get into the world-changing stuff. You are a photographer for the Blowfish catalog, which is a sex toys catalog, and you're on their board of directors. Now, that must be pretty fun, too.
Yes, it is.
And how did you get hooked up with Blowfish?
Well, my wife and I have been friends with the founder since before he founded the company. And so we've known Christoph for well over a decade now. And
I have to move to the Bay Area. I'm stuck out here in rural Connecticut. I don't know any of these kind of people. But okay, so you started a website called posthuman.org.
Yes.
Before you started World Changing, and maybe this is our last digression. Why did you start a posthuman.org website?
One of the last pieces that I wrote, I had written a piece when I was at GBN for Howard Rheingold's Electric Minds website called The Last Human Century, in which I postulated that the 20th century would be the last one in which human beings could say that, to the best of their knowledge, humans are the only intelligent beings around, sentient beings around. That in the 21st century, through one or more of several different means, humans will no longer be alone in that regard. And I suggested that these different means could include invention, that is, the creation of machine or artificial intelligence, sentience, discovery, that would be the SETI actually stumbling across something, or a follow-on to SETI, or augmentation, and that I would include everything from bioengineering to cybernetic engineering to the human mind, sufficient to result in what would functionally be a separate species. Now, in years hence, I would also include better understanding of cetacean and other primate brains to be able. I think that we are actually we have other sentient creatures on this planet. We just don't necessarily recognize them as such. But so when I wanted to start up, get my own domain, posthuman was something that came to mind as being an interesting idea to play around with. Unfortunately, I didn't do much with the site. I used it as an archive of writings that I've done elsewhere, but didn't have the right spark to try to turn it into something that would garner any attention.
Well, by now you must have 10 times as much writing in the world-changing domain as you have anywhere else on the web. And I should mention that World Changing just won the very coveted Utney Reader Alternative Press Award. In which category was it?
That was on online cultural coverage.
Online cultural coverage.
And we were up against some heavyweight other sites. So I was not expecting us to win this at all. And it was quite literally one of those cases where being nominated itself was quite an honor, because other sites included Media Matters for America, Boing Boing, Smart Mobs, a checklist of places that I find to be some of the best websites on around, And to be listed among them was terrific, and to actually win was surprising and quite an honor for us.
How did it come about, the inspiration for World Changing? I mean, I see that it's a team of dozens now. You have correspondents all over the world who contribute.
Right. We have over a dozen regular contributors from eight different countries.
And the postings are very high quality. They're reportage. They're not just, as most of my blog posts tend to be, just long quotes from various places. But you really do have essays, which are the longer pieces, and then you have the shorter blog news pieces. And so what's the mission statement for World Changing?
Well, to put it as simply as we can, we're trying to dig up, identify, and connect a diverse set of models, tools, and ideas for building a better planet, and with a particular focus on environmental sustainability and design and technology, but also with an appreciation of the value of open source as a model and the need for democracy in sort of the broad sense to underlie whatever, you know, whatever we do as a civilization to build a better planet.
So you talk a lot about green technologies. You're very close with the Stirling Viridian movement types. Mm-hmm. You're close with the Boing Boing folks who are kind of the hip democratic cultural fringe chroniclers. So it's a variety of things. It's not just alternative technology. It's not just cultural change.
Right. We're trying. It's really kind of hard to describe us because we are so interstitial. You know, we reside in those gray, fuzzy areas between a number of different movements and ideas and approaches to building out the world. We are strongly environmental in our focus, and yet we have raised a number of issues with some of the traditional approaches to environmentalism. You know, and we categorically reject the knee-jerk technology rejectionism of many in the environmental movement. At the same time, we have no truck for those who are who have the kind of technology mania that blinds them to the implications and possible results of what they do.
Techno-libertarians.
Yes, exactly. Have you read Paulina Borsuk's Cyber Selfish?
Yes, absolutely.
We are.
She's a former guest.
I'm sorry?
Former guest on the show.
Great. We're quite conscious in our desire to avoid that path. So while we embrace technology, we also are conscious of the implications of that, which gives us a number of allies who are kind of, who like us, but aren't quite 100% with us in some regards. But it's fun. We started up in October of 2003. Initially, it was just Alex Steffen and myself. Alex and I, we've known each other for a long time. We were looking for a project to work on together. And in a way, we started worldchanging.com and .com and .org both work. We started World Changing as something to do while we found a project to work on together. And it took on quite a life of its own. We've been extraordinarily pleased with the result and we have quite a bit of gratitude towards the contributors and our allies and the people who have said great things about us.
Talked about a lot of different things on the World Changing blog. What's your focus in World Changing?
Well, my particular focus is on a couple of different things. Green design. I've been especially around urban design. I've been doing a lot of research and immersing myself in 21st century approaches to sustainable cities. I find that quite fascinating. Emerging technologies of all sorts. I'm probably, of the people who are regular world-changing posters, I probably have the greatest experience with studies of emerging technologies across the board, nanotechnology and biotechnology. And in particular, looking at the social implications of what these changes and these developments. And probably the most interesting and, in many respects, most important thing that I cover quite frequently at World Changing is the concept of leapfrogging, and that is when a a region or nation or community has been historically, the term social scientists often use is backwards, which has in general use more darker implications than sociologists and historians imply or necessarily mean. But when a region has been backwards economically or technologically, oftentimes it can move from this quote-unquote backwards position to being on the cutting edge without having to go through the intervening steps. And it turns out that leapfrogging as a concept has a great deal of relevance to how the developing world can adopt modern industry and especially energy technologies without having to go through a more polluting centralized power stage. And so there's just incredible work being done across the developing world with solar and wind and biomass and decentralized power grids and decentralized communication and just on and on. It's just really, when you look at it from the leapfrogging perspective, it's really remarkable the potential in the developing world to move through or move past kind of the things that are weighing us down here in the West, such as over-reliance on centralized power, as we saw what happened with the blackout a couple years ago, over-reliance on landmines. At this point, they're expecting this year for the number of, actually, I think it may have already happened, the number of mobile phones, cellular phones in India to outnumber the number of land phones in India. And we're not talking, this isn't just a couple million here and there, it's like 150 million of each.
The model of leapfrogging seems to be determined by situations in which the industrialized West is invested and has sunk capital in a particular technological mode or technological organization, and the developing world does not, and then this new technology allows them to get to do something more adventurous than what we do.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
It's interesting because I think you recently wrote about healthcare leapfrogging, which I think, most people have not looked at this as much, but the notion that there are certain kinds of healthcare that we're invested in the industrialized North, that that there may be ways of getting around and doing something better in the developing world.
In this case, the legacy sunk costs that are tying us down are more social than technological in that. We're really tied to the mega pharmaceutical corporation model for doing our medical research here in the U.S. To a lesser extent in Europe, but still, you still have some really big centralized pharmaceutical concerns there. In the South, in particular, the three examples that come to mind are Brazil, Cuba, and India. That's not an issue, and because their needs are often more, I don't say more basic, but there are health concerns in the South that American and Western pharmaceutical concerns companies are just not interested in dealing with, like malaria. And so biotechnology and a more open source approach to doing pharmaceutical and biomedical research is really taking off in the developing world, and it's having some important results. I mean, there have been innovations coming from Cuba and Brazil and India and South Africa, that we're not just talking about copycat research, and we're not just talking about making pirated generic versions of Western drugs. We're talking about true innovation.
There's an alternative retroviral therapy that was invented in India, which they were marketing for 1% of the cost of the antiretrovirals from the North.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I think that's an amazing, and of course, from the transhumanist point of view, the notion that the developing world may innovate some of these human enhancement technologies in ways that the developed world, for various political ideological reasons, may not is kind of interesting, scary in some ways as well.
Right. I really do expect that we'll see some of the most cutting edge and in some ways disturbing developments coming out of China, because they have simultaneously a very well-educated populace and a very different cultural perspective on the value of or Prefetus blastocyst and things like that. I mean, they're much more willing to be experimental on human biology. I mean, we're already seeing that happening, and I think that's going to be an accelerating trend.
Well, I've really had the great pleasure of having recently had you appointed participated in a decision-making process that resulted in having you appointed as the fellow at the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies focusing on global health. And so I'm really looking forward to reading and helping to promote more of your work. And thank you for joining us in that enterprise.
Thank you.
And so I want everyone to go and take a look at worldchanging.org. It's a wonderful blog, and it's one that you should have on your blog lines list or your daily blog reading list. Are any other spinoffs planned out of the World Changing project? Are you planning video, audio, things like that?
We've been talking about podcasting. We're at kind of a critical stage. We've been around for 14 months. We've gotten big enough that we're actually going to have to shift hosting services because the traffic has been incredible. And actually, this is just as an aside, it's been just terrific, the support we've gotten this last week. We've done we've focused quite a bit on issues surrounding the South Asian tsunami and the big Southeast Asia tsunami website was tsunamihelp.blogspot.com. was developed in part out of the efforts of a couple of our contributors from India, and so this last week has really drawn a sharp focus on the ability of world changing to garner attention for key issues. But we're still trying. So we're at a point of trying to figure out, well, what do we do next? Now we've been entirely self-funded, which has been great, because it's given us some freedom to do things that being tied to a particular single funder or advertiser may not have let us do. But that's sort of reaching a conclusion. And so, again, what do we do next? One element of world changing that I didn't mention earlier, and I think it's important to keep in mind, is that unlike a lot of other future-oriented, environmental-oriented, social change-oriented websites and weblogs and the like, we have a very conscious agenda to focus on solutions, not on problems. What we said early on was that there are thousands of places to go on the web if you want to find out what's wrong with the planet. We want to be the place you go to when you want to know what to do about it. So we don't try to pretend that there aren't problems. We just assume, for the most part, that you already know what those problems, and you're looking for answers, solutions. And so it's been very empowering and inspiring to be part of this group of people who are really focused on trying to make the world a better place and looking for hands-on, concrete ways of doing it and not just sitting around, saying, well, wouldn't it be great if? Well, here, let's actually try to make it happen.
Well, again, I'm full support, and I encourage everyone to go and read Jamay's work at worldchanging.org, and I really want to thank you for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts with me, Dr. J, you can contact me at jhughes@changesurfer.com. That's jhughes@changesurfer.com. Or you can read my Change Surfing columns at betterhumans.com or check out the collaborative Cyborg Democracy blog I participate in at cyborgdemocracy.net. Or you can read my new book, Citizen Cyborg. For more details about Citizen Cyborg, visit cyborgdemocracy.net. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3, thanks to the A Infos Radio Project. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.